Calling all lovers of mystery and fans of a good story. If you haven't already heard me talk about June's journey, you're in for a treat. It's time to don your detective hat in this free hidden object mobile game that delves into the captivating journey of June Parker, a self-proclaimed detective on a quest to unravel the mystery surrounding her sister's untimely death. In June's journey, you get to play as June, deciphering clues and unveiling secret plots within thousands of beautifully illustrated scenes. And did I mention it's set in the glitzy 1920s? New chapters are added weekly, so you will never run out of new thrills to uncover, and you can also personalize and decorate your very own Orchid Island where the story takes place. How sharp are your detective skills? Find out when you download June's Journey on your Android or iOS device, or play online via Facebook Games. Your detective journey awaits.
Contained herein are the heresies of Radolf Buntwine, erstwhile monk turned traveling medical investigator. Join me as I uncover the blasphemous truth of a plague-ridden world, that ours is not a loving God, and we are not its favored children. The Heresies of Radolf Buntwine, coming January 2nd, wherever podcasts are available.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to IGN UK Podcast 401. I heard 400 was shit.
It was terrible, mate. Although...
It was terrible for me.
What they've heard that we haven't heard is our banging new theme tune.
Yeah.
Which I'm still... I'm thinking about it now and I want to leave and just go listen to it.
Yeah, so Luce just... Well, I should say, I'm Daniel Krupa. I'm joined by Joe Screbbles.
Hello.
And Lucy O'Brien.
Hello.
Hello. It's good to pop over just for this podcast.
How can we afford that?
It's all that sweet ad revenue we're on now.
Yeah, that's it.
It's all that CPV money we got.
Yeah, and all that money I get from Microsoft for giving Sony games bad reviews. I just decided to
based on that
to
money,
use that to fly
we're
over here.
Flying you around the world on that money.
Uh-huh, those brown envelopes behind the back of public toilets. They really help out. Is that where Gav is? Is he on the podcast? We've done an exchange program.
Coming back. He's going to be found face down in Sydney Harbour.
Gav on the podcast would be something
danger.
Special.
Danger.
Yeah.
We should say, so last week was podcast 400, which I wasn't at because I had food poisoning and I was in a really bad way. But
hungover.
I hoped everyone had a nice time.
Hungover,
yeah. I'm just an absolute worm. I can't even hang.
Couldn't be arsed.
No, I went home. Oh, it was so bad. I woke up on Friday morning. And I woke up at like 5 a.m. with like anxiety. And I was like, oh, what's this feeling? Don't know what this is. Why am I nervous? And I realized it wasn't nerves. It was actually crippling stomach pains. And I went to the toilet and basically exploded.
Oh, no.
I'm having a panic attack that results in me exploding.
Well, they are kind of similar sensations.
Yeah, I was like, and I just went and I exploded. And I thought, I'll have a little sleep. I'll set an alarm for 2 in the afternoon, see how I am. Probably be able to make it in. No, I couldn't even move.
Was it both ends? Or
no,
was
it was
one?
Primarily mouth.
Right.
But it was shit coming out of my mouth.
Right.
That's the worst,
it's
man.
The worst.
I'm
lucky I didn't get septicemia. But yeah, I heard it was a great night.
It was fantastic.
Yeah, people keep asking me what my three things were going to be. Mm. My three things were going to be Jonathan Creek.
Yep.
The particular shot in, so just to fill you in,
yes,
we did on our live show a top 10 IGN list of everything.
Top 7,
because like IGN's known for doing lists,
yeah,
maybe some lists that don't need to exist. And we did like top everything. So everyone picked three things and then we judged which would go into IGN's definitive everything. And it was like stupid stuff like Rick Mail,
VR, dogs, a video of a hawk dropping a snake on a barbecue, when Mr. Blobby wasn't allowed to go to America.
Yeah.
Overwatch.
That was about it, I think.
Is that 6 or 7?
Yeah,
I'm missing one, aren't I? Oh, Cardi did. What was Cardi's roast dinners.
Roast beef, roast dinners.
Yeah,
mine were going to be, so first one was Jonathan Creek. Mm-hmm. Did you watch Jonathan Creek?
No, but I'm familiar with it.
With the oeuvre of Jonathan Creek.
Yeah.
The mop
top. And the certain age
detective.
Of audience that watches Jonathan Creek.
Not who did it, it's how you done it. The second thing was the one shot in Halloween where he's standing half outside a hedge.
Okay.
Because I really, to this day, that's the most disturbing thing I've ever seen. And I went through a phase as a kid where I'd half stand outside around corners just for my mum. And then the final thing was Mr. Frosty, which was a plastic toy that you could basically make your own frozen treats in. And I asked for that 3 years in a row at Christmas, and I never got it. And I'm still bitter about that.
So you could actually eat the treats.
Like you would basically fill up water with like pop in, and you'd freeze it, and you put Mr. Frosty into the freezer, and he'd come out and he'd like dispense frozen treats from his chest, or you can take his arms off and that's like a popsicle.
That was
my mum was like, it's just going to be sticky and you'll never, you'll use it once, it'll be sticky. I was like, no, if I have this one thing, it'll make my life complete in ways that you wouldn't understand.
That was the age of toys where you made things.
Yeah, like candles.
Creepy crawlers ovens.
Yeah.
Those little, the little cookie ovens with the hot light bulb inside.
Also, do you ever get those where it's like, I had it, it was like Frankenstein, Dracula and the Mummy, and it was like a powder mix, and you put it into like a squidgy mold.
Oh, yeah.
And then you peel it off, and then you would paint it.
Yeah.
But I would get really impatient and take the mold off before it was set, and I'd just like touch it and it would just crumble. And in many ways, that's like every relationship I've ever had.
With a monster.
With a monster.
There's also like those tiny little sponges, like those sponge dinosaurs. They advertise like grow to enormous size. And
oh, mate. Kids don't know. They're born these days.
Do they have triops? I bet they don't have triops nowadays.
What's triops?
You know those little, they're like prehistoric creatures that you have, like they're little fish things.
Oh, yeah, yeah,
and
yeah.
You just empty like a sachet of
like
their eggs into
the
water.
Sea monkeys.
All, yeah, they're kind of like sea monkeys, except they grow to like bigger sizes.
Does it?
And my ones, just one of them ate all the rest, and there was just one big lonely triops.
That's invaluable.
Which is
out,
like every
kids.
Relationship I've ever had.
It's one devouring the other.
It's just destroyed everyone around
She's
me.
She's the winner. That's my girl. This is what this podcast is about. Because we've always said, like, MVC, you've got Nintendo covered. Unlocked has got Xbox covered. This is where we come into our own.
90s toys and how they relate to our depression.
Yeah. So first thing on the agenda, Lucy, what are you doing here? We've covered that on bribe money.
Bribe money.
First thing is we've finally all seen it.
Yes.
So we're going to talk about it, I think. I think we've got varying levels of enthusiasm for that movie. But it's been a huge success.
Enormous. Mm.
Like, I think you could probably see that coming when the first trailer did more views in 24 hours than the Force Awakens trailer.
That's absurd.
You know
that?
That is insane. I mean, I'm just like, regardless of what I thought about the film, which we will get into, but I am just stoked that a horror movie has done so well.
Yeah.
You know, as someone who loves horror, I'm really happy to see that movie just steamrolling at the box office.
And also, like, relatively speaking, big budget horror, because horror is this thing where, even like from Halloween, which we mentioned already, like, doesn't cost traditionally a lot to make, but it's hugely profitable because people just go nuts for a really good horror movie. Whereas this was like 30 million, I think.
Okay.
But it's going to unlock a bigger budget for the second part, which I think they've talked about it needing a bigger budget.
Oh, it definitely needs a bigger budget.
They're going to do the crazy cosmic stuff, which was in the first screenplay draft of this one, like Cary Fukunaga's script. And I think one of the reasons he walked away is they didn't have the budget to do the kind of crazy interdimensional stuff.
They wouldn't let him have that turtle that they all talk to.
The turtle. Yeah. Do you see all the turtle references
in
the movie?
I don't know anything about the book. I've never read it.
Yeah.
But I heard about that afterwards and all the references to turtles throughout and was like, that's weird.
I know,
what,
it is a weird
cool
thing.
Decision.
So, like, Joe, what did you think?
I loved it. I really loved it. I don't, like I say, I don't have a huge connection to the original source material. I only watched the miniseries 2 or 3 months ago when this started picking up.
Oh my God, did you think it was quite embarrassing?
Oh yeah, absolutely.
It's so embarrassing now. So
it's weird because the sort of practical effects and the scares and stuff are still very good. And
yes.
Tim Curry's very good.
Yes.
But everything else is hokey bullshit.
Oh, isn't it though?
It's mad.
And the acting is just so... I mean, the adults are bad.
Oh my God.
The kids are pretty good.
Most part, yeah.
Adults are rough.
The, is it Billy, Stuttering Man?
Bill.
He is like astonishingly bad.
But he's the most famous person in it. What's he called? He's John Boy from the Waltons, and he's
is he?
I don't know. Yeah.
Anyway, that
he's in the Americans as well.
But I thought basically this feels like its own thing. It's using the source material to create what is a very zeitgeisty horror film, which is, you know, obviously indebted to Stephen King with the kids kind of growing up together in the midst of mad cosmic bullshit happening to them.
I think Kids Against Monster is always like a winning
combo.
Just a good structure. And I thought the scares were fun and I thought the kids were fun. But that's kind of I think we've all separately said this in the office. It's a lot more fun than it is scary, but I'm kind of fine with that. That's what I was in it for. So I got a lot out of it. I also thought its movements and stuff were brilliant. Like, I desperately want a gif of the bit where he's doing a strange dance in a perfectly locked shot.
Yeah, and his head's just bobbing
with his head not moving and the rest of his body moving around him. It's fantastic.
I really liked his physicality.
Yeah, the bit where are we getting into it?
Yeah, I think it's been out for a couple of weeks now, and I think a lot of people listening to this podcast have.
Let's say.
Should we do
a timer thing?
Yeah.
5 minutes?
We do this sometimes because you know what people like with spoilers. We've talked about spoilers ad nauseum on this podcast.
Right.
Let's have
a five-minute timer.
We'll just talk about certain things.
Right. If you haven't seen it and you actually care about spoilers, skip ahead 5 minutes starting now. Go.
The bit where he unfolds out of the fridge is really good.
No, that bit was brilliant. I really liked when they started playing up his physicality down in the sewers. That was when I sort of felt that his Pennywise came into his own.
I feel like I could have done more. I actually, like, unlike a lot of like horror movie monsters or antagonists, I want more Pennywise. I want more of him like tormenting them.
Yeah.
Because like the most dialogue he has is the first scene in the movie. Mm-hmm. And then he kind of disappears for quite a long time.
Yeah.
And I like Tim Curry's more of a presence, like constantly tormenting in their ear, whispering.
That's it. He's a very vocal.
Yeah. I would have liked to have heard more from his Pennywise, because there's a great bit where they're in Nabolt Street house and he's about to attack Eddie. And then Richie and Bill are upstairs and they have the three door choices of not scary, scary, and very scary. And they go through not scary, see something, and then they realize it's not real. They open it again, there's nothing there. So they kind of puncture the illusion. Mm. And at that moment, he just like stops dead and turns around and leaves Eddie. And when he comes down, he says something like, "Oh, is it not real enough for you, Billy? It was real enough for Georgie." And it's like, I want more of him speaking and like really kind of getting in their heads.
It's weird, like, thinking about it, there aren't many vocal antagonists in horror movies. No. You don't get chatty evil in that way.
I mean, there is Freddy, who's the most chatty.
Yeah, that's true.
Like, well, it's like there's actually a good comparison there, like the kind of vaudevillian villain, where it's like make it like Lord of Misrule.
And and every scare is like a set piece. Like instead of just like, oh, well, I'm evil.
That's
what
I think. Like, this
bad.
Was quite, you know, like those Nightmare on Elm Street. It's where very it's like set piecey,
theatrical.
Where you can think of a good idea, and because he can be anything and turn like warp reality, gives you a great jumping off point for just a sequence.
While we're in spoiler zone, can we just talk about the fact that the Georgie murder is so much more graphic than I expected it to be, and it played it so straight and so similar for so long that when he took his arm off,
that was my favorite. Like, in terms, if we're talking about pure scares, because I will say that one of my biggest criticisms of the film was that I did not find it scary enough. And I'm a huge fan of the book, and the book is really disturbing, you know. And this film took it into more of a Stranger Things kind of family-friendly horror, which is fine. Mm. It's just that I wanted more of that darkness that existed in the book.
Well, there's great images in the book, which is, I guess, why I find the scene in Halloween where he's just standing on the hedge so effective. There's a great scene in the book where he's just stood opposite the river, and he's just there with one balloon, just standing. It's in the TV adaptation as well. And he's just standing there looking, and then they look back, and then there's 1,000 balloons above him. And that's why I like the scene in the movie where he's just stood there in front of the house. I find that way more effective.
Well, it's more chilling, isn't it? And I think that it was interesting choice to have the scares be so sort of relentless and CG heavy, and when I think personally that they could have been a little simpler, a little less expensive, because I think one of the biggest creeps for me in the miniseries was when Ben's dad is standing on the water.
Yeah, and then
he's
every
in
time
his
you look back,
uniform, and every time you look back, he's
got the
getting
pom-poms.
The pom poms, and there's just that horrible sort of music in the background. And you know, for me, that is more chilling. And it was in the clunky, goofy miniseries, and that was more chilling to me than any scare in the new movie.
Yeah, I think that's totally fair.
And I guess I just wanted a little bit more of that threat, as I think, as you were saying before, Krupa, this idea that he is just there and he is taunting them instead of just basically, oh, I'm going to chase you and then be another gross monster and then be another gross monster
I think one thing it does really well is this idea that Pennywise is just this kind of fragile embodiment of something much more abstract. Like at the end when it, I think it's called Beth, and when he takes her into the Deadlights, and just
Bev.
And like the head just kind of opens up and it keeps opening, and it's just like he ceases to be the clown, it kind of fractures. Same when at the beginning with Georgie, when he thinks Georgie's going to leave, he starts panicking and he gets like really hungry and he's like... I think it does that well, whereas in the original, I feel like it's just Tim Curry is such a big presence.
It is just right. A monster clown.
Got 12 seconds. Anything else?
Didn't like Bev being taken into the sewers. She originally went into the sewers on her... she originally went to Nibolt Street on her own volition.
And we're out.
And we're out.
Oh, lovely. Oh, there you go.
What a lot of lovely spoilers.
Yeah. If you... go see it this weekend. You can go back and listen to that. You probably won't, but, you know, up to you.
Well, I think Lucy and I have made our thoughts clear. I don't fully know what you thought of it.
I had a brilliant, brilliant time. I think I've watched the original TV miniseries probably more than 20 times growing up.
Jesus Christ.
So it's like such a huge presence in my head. And then I went and read the novel when I was a teenager. But I still loved it.
Did it live up to what you wanted?
I think my expectations were so high for it. But I really liked his Pennywise. I just could have, like I said, like I wish like more of it because I feel... because in the TV... Oh, I'm spoiling it. We're doing spoilers again. I really liked it. I think my expectations were unrealistically high, but I still think it was very good and I can't wait for part two.
It does feel like it would have made a good TV series. Like, I know they couldn't have spent as much and that kind of stuff, but there is something too, like... The original miniseries was long.
Yeah.
And having like a really proper, you know, like 8 to 12 episodes of.
Yeah, because you could anchor an episode in each character.
Yeah, you could really dig.
And that way you would have got far more character development across all the kids because some of them were really pushed aside.
Particularly Mike. Yeah. Like, there's just nothing.
Well, he has way more in the original script.
Yeah.
This is not a spoiler for the movie, so I'm going to say it now just because a lot of people won't read this original script. There's an amazing, amazing scene in the original Cary Fukunaga script, which is unbelievably good, where it just starts and what you're in like a kind of 1800s like mining town, like logging town, which is Derry before it settled around like 1790. And this is guy, he's just got off work from logging and he goes into this little tavern and he goes up to the bar. Bartender pours him some whiskey. He starts doing shots. There's people playing cards in the background. There's someone in the background playing the piano. And then just out of nowhere, he picks up his hatchet and he just starts killing people in the bar. But no one reacts. Like, so he's just like smashing people's heads in with this hatchet. They're bleeding out. Bartender continues to pour him drinks. He goes around, just murders everyone. And as you're watching the scene unfold, you realize in the background, the person playing the piano is Pennywise.
Oh, that's chilling.
So
and
good.
And it's just like, that's an amazing scene.
Yeah.
Like, I find chilling. That really unsettling.
Yeah.
I would really want to see Cary Fukunaga make
something
a
like
proper
that.
Horror because I rewatched True Detective recently and enjoyed it way more the second time than I did the first. I'm not sure why I didn't like it as much the first time, but just watching some of those moments where
it's
he gets
real
really
to
dark,
it's a real sinisterness to
the
that.
First time you see, I can't even remember the evil main evil guy, the Yellow King. Do it. There's this whole scene that I'd completely forgotten about where he keeps switching accents and all of his accents are perfect. And there's this sense of he's not, it feels Pennywise-y. It feels like this isn't a man.
He's a creature pretending to be a man.
He's just impersonating being all these different humans. And it's like, fuck,
totally.
That's so horrible. Yeah. It's amazing. Yeah.
So continuing on the line of horror, this sounds horrific, Lucy. Why have you done this to yourself?
So I've actually done this for a piece that's going to be going up later on in October to celebrate the upcoming Jigsaw movie. Basically, it's one of our sort of dismantling the Saw series.
So you watched every single one?
Yeah, putting together the timeline of Saw series, which is actually really complicated. Like,
what?
You don't think so.
Yeah.
But it's really complicated. Like, I didn't actually, like, because I was writing the script for this, I didn't actually get to Saw, the events of Saw 1 until 500 words. I'd already written 500 words before I got to the events of Saw 1.
Okay.
Because all the movies go back in time, yeah, and then they have this stuff with parallel Jigsaw's, like, timelines.
Wife and baby and all,
yep,
that sort of stuff.
Yeah, stuff that happened, that the flashbacks, and then there are acquaintances of acquaintances. And it is just so complicated. And, like, basically, it starts off fairly coherent. The first three are, so I watched all of them back to back. First three are pretty coherent, like, varying in quality. The first one is still the best, but varying in quality. Then it just goes off the rails. I am talking, like, insanely off the rails. So you know how in Alien Covenant, sort of, Ridley Scott wanted to go back and explain why the xenomorphs,
yeah,
were
exactly,
created?
Yes.
As if that was a question that people wanted answering.
Yeah.
So the makers of the Saw movies have decided that they, that people are interested enough in every single tiny detail of the first Saw movie and the second Saw movie that every single thing needs to be explained in the subsequent, like, five films, as if we care that much. Do you know what I mean? So, like, every, like, there's, like, every little detail is kind of like, oh, that key that you saw in Saw 2.
What fucking key?
Oh, we revealed what that key was for in Saw 5. Do you know what I mean? God. Like, and it's just, like, as if we've all been holding our breath waiting to find out.
Yeah, it's as if they wanted, like, a Star Wars extended universe,
yeah,
for Saw.
As
it's
a
true.
As a spin-off movie.
Oh, that's very good.
So the new one, is it after the events of all the other ones? Is that
it's
the set, idea?
It's, yeah, 10 years after Jigsaw's
and
death.
And he's, like, is he supposed to be alive, or is he, like,
well,
he's had stuff in motion for 10 years?
Like, we don't know, like, whether he's had stuff in motion for 10 years, and, you know, he's,
he was
got all
good
these
at planning shit.
Acquaintances. He was, yeah. Oh, he was amazing at planning. Yeah. So we don't know, but what
he's
is interesting...
He's got a really stuffed Trello board.
Oh,
he's,
yeah, 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 yeah.
His Trello. Oh.
His Trello would be insane.
So many
things
plugins
for Billy to do.
But yeah, the idea behind Jigsaw is actually quite interesting because they sort of wanted to cut, they wanted to end it because the last couple of entries didn't do very well at the box office. But apparently these two, I think they're brothers, had such a good idea for a new entry into the series that they sort of went, okay, we'll give it a shot because this idea is so strong. And, like, we don't actually learn a lot from the trailer. Like, the trailer is just basically like, oh, there are all these murders happening, and they seem to be kind of in step with Jigsaw's MO. And that's kind of it.
Mm.
And it's just about the cops investigating that, which is, like, the basis for every Saw movie ever.
Yeah.
But, like, I'm really interested to see what the twist is this time around, because if it was interesting and original enough to have them say, have these execs say, all right, let's keep this franchise going and start a new Jigsaw cinematic universe. I, you know, I'm intrigued. Because I really do feel bludgeoned over the head by the end, by Saw 7.
That will happen if you watch.
I was. I felt like
the
I
irony,
felt like I was in one of his machines.
Doing this, watching every single Jigsaw movie, Saw movie, is something that I feel like Jigsaw himself would punish.
Totally.
Like, that's a waste of your life.
Totally. It's like, stab your eyes out or watch all of these, and
this is your wake
and
up
lose
call,
part of your soul. So anyway, I just wanted to sort of make a note that I'd watched all those movies back to back, and that if you do have the inclination to do so, please space it out, because doing it all in one go is not pleasant. It's not a pleasant experience.
What was that? Was that like 12 hours?
Something like that, yeah.
Is that, I mean,
by the end, I was sort of like, I was like, it was like a Clockwork Orange, you know, I was like holding my eyes open.
You've talked about it from the sense of, like, putting together a chronology. Like, how does that series just hold up in terms of quality of watching films in that way? Like, is it actually enjoyable
in any
way?
Some of them are pretty enjoyable. Like, actually, Saw 6 is pretty good.
Oh, really?
Yeah, surprisingly quite good. It's got a bit of a message on universal healthcare.
Oh.
Which is, you know, which is interesting, a little deep for the Saw franchise.
Get it to Congress!
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I think it got, like, 28% on Rotten Tomatoes as opposed to the usual, like, 6.
Fair play.
But, you know, the sort of the traps are still pretty fun.
Mm.
But by the end, if you're watching them like I was watching them, they sort of lost all impact.
Yeah.
Like, I was just like, oh, just, I don't care. This is shocking and people are screaming and there's blood everywhere and intestines on the floor. But I'm just like, eh.
What's the reason, where's the Billy doll come from? Has that got a reason?
Yeah, so the reason behind that is, Oh, spoilers.
Yeah, let's start a timer, guys.
The reason behind that is that his unborn child was killed, was miscarried.
Yeah, I remember
by
that.
Like,
someone pushed a door
into his pregnant wife. And he had built this little doll.
For his kid.
For his kid called Gideon. And then he sort of decided that, you know, that would be the mascot of his crimes. But so he built these bigger...
His kid would have been fucked up.
I like that. Yeah, totally. It's like, oh, he's actually, you know, he's trying to, like, do these things so people are, like, reaffirming their life and, like, getting their shit together. He was already gone. Like,
oh, so he was like, already...
making that for his kid. Going, what's that?
Come on, mate.
He was totally deranged.
That's a bit much, John. lovely. Kingsman is also out this week. Mm. And now I have seen Kingsman, and it has got very mixed reviews.
Mm.
So Rory and I saw it together after about 5 pints.
Classic.
And good amount of pints.
As the IGN UK standard.
Way of seeing a movie. Yeah. And that's how we saw Das Boot together, and that's how we saw Kingsman together.
Flew by.
I think that's like... I don't think it's a bad movie at all, but it is a very silly movie.
Mm.
And I think... I don't know. I've heard people who enjoyed the first one not even liking this one. I think what I didn't like about this one is, this is non-spoilers, I thought the first one did a brilliant job of you following Eggsy along his journey from like a council estate kid to this like one like almost gentleman spy.
Mm.
And in this movie, it's not really centered on him as a character or his like personal life. It is just a pretense for like literally blowing up everything of the first movie and just doing crazy, crazy action set to music with this kind of hyper frantic style, which is really, really fun because Matthew Vaughn's just like had this incredible like bunch of sequences where, you know, it's people grabbing machine guns out of midair, and it all looks like one continuous shot.
Mm.
People like hitting a baseball and the baseball exploding and all this kind of crazy action.
Does he do that really off-putting thing with action scenes where he goes slightly too fast just to slow it down for a second and then go back too far? I hate that shit.
It happens a lot, and by the final sequence, which it's that thing where the first film, the amazing sequence in the church, where Colin Firth just kills like 25 people. It tries to top that in the final act, and it doesn't succeed because it's just, it can't be as impactful as that.
Well, it's also the first film, that scene is really the first time you've seen Harry in full flow.
Yeah.
Like, you've got the tension of knowing that this man's a genius.
You've got like a little hint in the bar scene, but nothing comparable
exactly.
to that.
I want
to
be a genius fighter.
I want to be a genius fighter. He just gets it. It's like that really shit bit in Sherlock Holmes where he's...
He's
the
thinking
Robert Downey Jr.
Yeah,
one,
like,
where he's
do
like,
this, that,
oh, left hook, well,
incapacitate.
Yeah, so annoying.
Yeah. But yeah, it does that in the end, and me and Rory speaking about it afterwards. It's because they try and so it looks like one continuous sequence, but obviously every time it speeds up and slows down, they're like matching shots,
right?
Or
right,
there's like little interstitial CGI shots to link different takes, and probably didn't have the highest budget in the world. It's probably decent budget, but you can still kind of see the world more. It doesn't impact your enjoyment that much, but it's that kind of staccato action. But it looks impressive and it is fun. Like there's not off, you don't often see those things happen in a big budget action movie.
Okay,
like it's got a sense of humor to its action sequences. The first film was controversial for a scene at the very end of the movie, the anal sex joke.
I don't even remember. It's been so long.
It's crap.
Yeah, it's crap. And there's a scene in this movie that I think will be similarly controversial. It's just a bit like, I just don't think it needs it. I mean, even me and Rory, like 5 pints in, groaned at it.
Especially like in a second film when so much was made of the first film's joke. It just feels like they're doing it on purpose. Like they're just like... annoying people on purpose.
Yeah.
Like,
oh, I don't like that. Yeah, that's just boring.
Yeah, it's just like, that's it. Like, if you're going to offend people, do it because you've got a good reason to, not because
it's not
you were annoyed
it's
the
not,
first time people
bit,
were offended.
It's a bit gross, to be honest.
Yeah.
But Pedro Pascal plays a statesman, which is the US equivalent of the Kingsman. And he plays an agent called Whiskey. He's unbelievably good in this movie.
Really?
He's so charming, and I've not seen him do comedy before. He's really, really funny.
You could pick that.
Yeah,
from,
he's very charismatic.
Yeah,
he's
very, just knew it would just take a little
effortlessly charming
sidestep into comedy.
Yeah,
and
he's got that like Antonio Banderas thing of you just like every time he smiles, you're like smiling at me.
Like, I was melting. I was melting like a Malteser bot. But I had a great time. I'd go see it with a bunch of mates, have a couple of beers beforehand, take a beer in even. Have an even better time.
For an unlicensed cinema.
Right, final thing we're going to talk about this week is a show that went live on Netflix, which I actually watched while you were all doing the podcast last week, American Vandal.
Have you seen this, American Vandal?
I have not seen American Vandal, but I have seen people on my Twitter feed talking about it as if it's been some kind of really pleasant surprise.
Yeah, so the trailer, you showed me the trailer. Yeah, you were outlining the basic premise for people.
Okay, so it's a show that presents itself as a perfectly like realistic Making a Murderer style documentary with all the sort of twists and turns, like the tropes of that new true crime series, that kind of style
Serial
that's emerging.
As well.
So very presenter-led, like the presenters on screen discussing things, very like This American Life. Yeah, that kind of feeling that they're part of your conversation, like you're talking to them and you're having the same thoughts as they are. Except it's about a high school car park where 27 cars had dicks drawn on them. And the entire thing is this kid's been expelled for graffitiing dicks all over the teacher's cars, and this kid, Peter Maldonado, who's like, he's the archetypal, the kid who's not that popular and finds a way to make himself popular by doing something cool and different.
Yeah, because he's like part of the AV club, or like it's a high school TV channel. So he's using all that equipment to make this project, which is this kind of expose or investigation.
And like, he doesn't believe that Dylan could possibly have done this. And his like the key piece of evidence, and this is in the first episode, is that he's been drawing dicks for years, and he constantly Snapchats himself drawing dicks. But he always draws hairs on the balls, and there's no hairs on the balls on the graffiti. So this becomes like the key.
This is a smoking gun.
The smoking gun. And it's really weird because for the first three episodes, I was going, "Isn't that funny?" I'm not like, it's a good central joke, but for an eighth episode series, I was like, "There's not many jokes." And then suddenly you realize, oh, it's not that much of a comedy. Like, it's a stupid premise, but it's just a really well-constructed mystery story.
Yeah.
Because it starts doing really smart stuff with the documentary goes viral halfway through. And so all the episodes after that are done in the context of everyone knows he's making this documentary. And the school doesn't like how it's being presented, but the students love it. So demonstrations start happening and people start like waving at the camera and stuff.
There's people on YouTube making fan theories about this case that's not yet solved.
So there's this whole episode about him responding to the fan theories online, which is really smart.
I think what he does brilliant is you basically taking all that stuff and turning it into additional material for future episodes.
Yep.
Same with like social media. Like, there's this absolute magnificent scene where they have to like basically locate a can of spray paint at a party. So he starts constructing a timeline from people's social media. Which is like forensic detail. So he's looking at Instagram posts and Snapchats and putting together this timeline in a very forensic way.
It's a whole episode centered around this one big party, and him and his co-documentarian were like the only people not invited. So there's this tinge of like sort of
looking in
like
at it.
Anger at it as well, which is really nice. Like, it captures a lot of that high school angst. And they keep going, like, there's one bit where they spot this other unpopular kid and he's at the party and they're like, what, he was there? And it's like genuinely incredible, the forensic way they break down this thing that they've obviously made up for the show, but is so, it feels so real. It's amazing. Like, it's a really smartly put together thing.
Do you know what I love about this premise? Is that I do, you know, I'm into true crime and all that sort of thing. Like, you know, go as dark as you want, I'm there. But I do acknowledge that there is something quite sort of intrusive and perverted about finding glee in these terrible stories and you know, being such a voyeur in these often just tragic stories.
And unsolved things.
And, you know, people's lives ruined, and we're all sitting there in front of our TVs, like, you know, with our beers and chips and just like, ugh. Yeah, there's something really kind of gross about it.
Yeah.
But I love this because it sounds like it still feels like there's stakes, but it's not those kind of terrible human tragedy stakes.
I think it really understands why you find these sort of stories so engrossing, even though, because it gets you hooked, even though the central, like, it's just drawing dicks.
Yeah.
It's something about the intrigue and the suspicion, and also just all the social media around it as well. Like,
it doesn't even feel like a satire of social media. It just feels like it gets how that's used now, God, people definitely younger than me.
If you're at high school now,
what? It must be terrible. If that's what it's actually like, and maybe it is adults making it up, but if that's what it's like, it's fucking terrifying. I would hate it. It just does. And it also really smartly deals with the intrusion of making something like this as well. Like, there are real repercussions, like, particularly towards the end. It's not afraid to get quite dramatic about how it shows you things. And, like, they are making a second season as well, and it leaves enough open that you're like, shit, I actually really want to see how this fake case progresses. It's really smart. It's
amazing.
Like, super surprising, especially after two episodes going, I'm not that into this.
Yeah, I didn't know how it was going to sustain for 8 episodes, but around the midway, you're like, oh, I get it now.
Yeah.
So that's American Vandal, and that's out on Netflix right now, and it is very good, says Joe. right, first bit of feedback is from me, and this is from a guy called Adam. Sorry I couldn't make it to podcast 450, but you're not paying attention, mate. It's podcast 400. But Simon mentioned he had a list of his top 100 music albums. So Simon is our new guy, Lucy, and he has a list of his top 100 films of all time, which he calls the SIAMDB.
SIAMDB.
Oh, my SIAMDB. God. Yeah. He is a genius.
It's got a custom graphic and everything.
Wow.
Simon mentioned he had a list of his top 100 music albums, but he didn't have a cool name. Well, I have a suggestion. How about, now that's what I call a cardi, instead of party.
Is that a thing? Now that's, I thought it was just,
I
now that's what,
I call,
music. Is there a party one?
Adam, write back and answer that question for
firstly
us.
Firstly, episode 450, then gets the now CD names wrong.
Come on, Adam, pull your finger out. He also says, PS, I was totally ready to hate the new theme music because I love the old one and hate change. But I've got to be honest, it totally won me over.
Oh, it's so
much better. It's a banger, that's why.
It's because that opening drum beat fucking hooks.
But I've been like that with music on podcasts where it's changed. And it's like initially like, oh, I'm not used to this. And then like in 3 weeks, I couldn't even hum you the original.
Football Ramble.
Yeah, I can't remember.
The new one's an absolute
monster. I can't remember what the original is.
I love that song. It's got cowbell in it.
All right, so this is from Arthur White. Hey gang, love the show and I need your advice. Actually, I should tell you the title of this email. Mm-hmm. So, about this Overwatch game you never shut up about.
Yep, there is that.
I can agree with you there. For the first time in about 4 years, I'll have a PC. While I have a PS4, I refuse to play FPSs with anything other than a mouse and keyboard, so I've therefore missed out on a lot. The question is this, since I want to start playing an FPS again, should I jump on board the Overwatch train or wait for Battlefront 2, which I certainly want to play, but is a couple of months away? Is it too late to get into Overwatch? Cheers from Down Under! All right!
Here we go.
All right, Arthur. Cheers from Down Under, Arthur.
Arthur, it's more than just an FPS. It's a way of life. It's a state of mind.
Oh, God.
It is.
The cult is strong.
It'll consume you.
I say that. I haven't played it for three weeks. I've been playing Destiny. So.
I know, but 3 weeks.
Yeah.
I don't know. Like,
I haven't played it for 3 weeks. You know, I'm well off.
Is that what you're shaking?
Yeah.
Crying.
I haven't had a drink in a day.
What do you think? I feel like Overwatch, play it.
Yeah, I certainly don't think it's too late.
Think it's too late. I think it's extremely accessible. And I think, you know, just because the character roster is a bit larger and there are more maps now, it's still as accessible as it ever was from day one. Like,
really good example is recently Cardi just joined the team and he never played Overwatch before and he started 6 weeks ago. Mm. He's now hooked on it.
He's absolutely cleaning up.
He absolutely
well.
Loves it.
He's great.
And, you know, he's still only playing one or two characters at the minute because he's still like finding his way. Because when he started playing, I realized there's so much to like communicate about like every map and every little bit and character, but he's just finding his way playing one character.
Well, that's it. You just play. I think we've said this on the podcast before. You just start as soldier, learn how the game types work, and then you start seeing how the other characters work, see which ones you hate playing against most, and start learning them.
Yeah,
because that way you're learning what they can do to you, and as such, you
how
can
to tackle
do
them
that back.
But yeah, or get both.
I mean, get both.
Definitely get both.
That's Space Combat and Overwatch, that'll be all right.
That's the third way.
That's the way to do it. This one's from Greg Rogers, our final piece of feedback, I believe. Am I right?
Yes.
Good. I want to go. So, I recently moved from my family farm in North Wales
What's that?
Just Gav. Wales, just waiting for Gav to say something. He's just not here. To live and work in London, where I know next to no one. In the lead up to the move, me and my brother used to joke about how I might run into the boys. I believe that's referring to you and the boys. And about out and about in the city and what I'd say if I did. Anyway, last Friday... Sorry, I lost my place. Anyway, last Friday, my second day in London, I was exploring my new local area on my own when who should cross the road ahead of me but none other than the one and only Daniel Krupa. I tried to decide whether or not to yell out, "Krupa!" and catch up to him. Before I came to a decision, he went into a supermarket, and as I didn't want to follow him in like some crazy stalker, that was that. I guess my question is, how do you guys feel about running into listeners? And what should I do if I run into Krupa again? Well, we've got just the man for you.
You should
attack him.
You should attack me. Just give me a hug.
Spear him.
Just give me a hug. I'd be happy with a hug.
Would you really?
Well, it depends on the person.
No, but I mean, if someone just came up to you on the street and started hugging you.
No, you'd need an intro first.
Say hello.
Krupa, hug.
Say hello. And then see if I'm amenable to a hug. And then if so, collect said hug.
What if it had been Vom Day and someone had come up and hugged you? They
would have got Vom on their back.
They don't know whether
that would have been
day.
A little souvenir.
Oh, God.
Bit of Krupa sick.
I don't know. I'd say hello.
Yeah, always say hello.
Yeah, I think that.
We had a lovely man come up to me and Gav on the tube the other day. He'd been at Podcast 400 and he just sat down next to us and was like, "I was at Podcast 400. And then started talking to us about how he's an animator on Wes Anderson's new film. We were like,
"Oh, that's amazing.
That's fucking wicked." What a cool thing
I
to happen
I bet you were like,
tube.
when he's like, "Oh, I'm working on a film," you're like,
"We
are you?"
We stated that subtext because he went, "Oh, a trailer for a film I'm working on is coming out this week." And we were like, "What film's that then?" And he went, "Oh, it's Wes Anderson's new film." And I just went, me and Gav were definitely both thinking that we'd have to feign interest for a few minutes there. He was like, "Yeah. That's cool."
So, yeah,
good
our advice
well.
Is be friendly, come up, say hello, and then
maybe
possibly
get
you'll get a hug. I don't know. I can't promise a
that's
hug.
That's nice validation as well, because sometimes you just feel like you're doing this sort of thing into the void.
Absolutely.
So it's nice when we actually, you know, people come up and say hey and introduce nice themselves. And, yeah, yeah. It's nice just to know that people
you're,
are
you're counteracting all like bad comments
totally.
By giving us one nice one.
That is true. That's
so
very true.
We would appreciate it very much. So one final thing to do before we leave. Now, currently, if you go to... So there's a charity called Special Effect Lucy that we do a lot of stuff with. Mm. I'm actually an ambassador of this charity now.
Are you?
So we raise money. So it's a really great charity that adapts video game controllers and consoles so people with physical disabilities can play video games. And they're currently doing an auction at the minute, and you can bid on a tour of the IGN office. And
such as it is,
and hang out with us for an afternoon. We go to the pub, and like if you're interested in games media or getting into video games, we'll answer any questions you have, and you just hang out with us for half a day. Currently, that's up to £520.
So if you're
which is unbelievable,
if you're rich,
so if you're rich, if you want to bid on that, I think there's about 4 or 5 more days on it. You can go to bit.ly/IGN auction, and obviously the money goes to a good cause. Don't go to us.
Not much of it.
So that's it for podcast 401, which I think will be a certified banger.
Yep.
Thank you for joining us, Lucy.
Thank you for having
me.
Thank you, Joe.
Thank you.
And thank you.
Nowadays, trends and news cycles change faster than we can blink. But there are some things that withstand the test of time. And if you're looking for a connection to something timeless, and maybe also a glimpse of life at a slower pace, I believe everyone can relate to the very human experiences explored in Jane Austen's novels. And that's where I come in. My name is Alison Larkin. I'm a writer, comedian, and narrator and host of The Jane Austen Podcast with Alison Larkin. I spent a lot of my childhood in the part of England where Jane Austen lived and wrote, and now that I live in the States, nothing gives me a sense of homecoming quite like narrating her books. On this show, you'll listen to award-winning narration, I'll give myself a pat on the back for that, as well as conversations with actors, writers, and other fascinating people who all share a passionate love for Jane Austen. So please, join me as we embark on a wonderful journey through Jane Austen's work. Be sure to listen and subscribe to The Jane Austen Podcast with Alison Larkin, wherever you get your podcasts.